The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show with me, Charles Christian, as once more we delve into the worlds of weirdness, urban myths, arcane history, geek culture, ghosts, magic, witchcraft, the occult, and anything else I think will intrigue you. This week's guest is Dr. Christina Downes. That's Christina with a K, and she is the Executive Director of the Texas Folklore Society. She is also the creator and host of the Crime Law podcast, which examines the intersections of folklore and true crime. Her research focuses include crime legends, online crime-solving communities, and representations of indigenous heroines in the United States and Mexico. You're going to enjoy this interview in which we cover everything from Pocahontas to whether serial killers have replaced fairy and alien abductions as the popular explanation for mysterious disappearances. On the true crime front, we also look at the Soda children disappearance and the contrasting cases of Crystal Grubb and Lauren Spira. Many years ago, they went on the tour of Williamsburg as well, and great suckers for Jamestown and the colonial Virginia thing, which, of course, is one of the topics you write about.
I do.
Pocahontas and John Smith, and also the sort of relationship between indigenous heroines and, I suppose we'd call them, the white settlers.
Yes.
How did that come about? Because, I mean, we're going to be talking about folklore and, in fact, and also true crime. But that's a sort of a bit of a, you know, an aside. What's the connection with that? What's the intriguing part for you of that?
So it started, it ended up being the subject of my dissertation, but it started off not from Virginia, from a family that moved all over the place, but I spent a lot of time in Virginia. And my background in terms of academics was in studying Latin America. And in Mexico, there's a Mexican history. There's a woman named Malinche, or La Malinche. She was an indigenous woman. She was spoken Nahuatl, which is the language associated with the people we would call the Aztecs. Mm-hmm. They called themselves the Mexica. She had been sold into slavery to the Maya as a child. So she spoke Nahuatl and Maya, and ended up then being given as a gift to Cortez when he arrived in the Yucatan. Mm-hmm. And she ended up being a translator for him when he found out that she could speak Maya and Nahuatl, because he had someone who could speak Maya and Spanish, but nobody who could speak Nahuatl.
Yeah.
And so she became his translator, eventually became his mistress, had a child by him, got married off to one of his lieutenants, and probably died very young, probably by the age of 30. And her life story is very similar to the story of Pocahontas. So if you just sort of look at them as folklorists do and do kind of a tale type analysis, break them down to their base elements, it's almost an identical story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But whereas Pocahontas has always been treated as a heroine and sort of this, you know, icon of American history, Malinche has, since Mexican independence, been referred to more as a traitor, as a whore, and kind of had the whole of the conquest put on her shoulders, that she was to blame for this because she helped Cortez in some way against the indigenous people. Mm-hmm. Now, she was a 15-year-old girl, and I'm not exactly sure what she was supposed to do to stop that from happening. But I started getting interested in the fact that these two women's stories were so similar and that they were treated so differently. And it actually kind of came about in, it's about 2005, mm-hmm. maybe. They were filming a movie. The movie The New World was being filmed in southeastern Virginia, and I was following a lot of the discourse on the casting of the role of Pocahontas, because the woman who was eventually cast in the role is half Quechua. Her family's from, they're an indigenous people to South America. Mm-hmm. And the reaction was sort of mixed about, well, at least they're finally casting an indigenous person to play this role. And, but why are they casting an indigenous South American woman instead of an indigenous North American woman? And just kind of interested in how these two women's stories were so similar and treated so differently. And then somewhere along the way, kind of a light bulb went off in my head about how these stories are also very similar to the stories you get about Saracen princesses in medieval romances. So we have a lot of these stories where there's, you know, some Christian knight who's over in the Middle East during the Crusades and encounters this beautiful Saracen woman who saves her from, saves him from her evil father and, you know, rescues him, converts to Christianity and goes back to his homeland with him. And, you know, the story is told about Thomas Becket's mother is, you know, one of these women that this story is not true, but that was the legend about his mother. And there's a lot of those stories. And it just kind of started really becoming clear to me how women are used as these means of understanding cultural contact, the female other, sort of this woman that's from outside, has, you know, the narrating cultures. Sorry, and so I think what really happened with Pocahontas and Malinche is that Mexico post-independence came to view itself as having a really strong indigenous heritage or having a mestizo heritage, a mixed heritage, and there was this push to reject everything Spanish, which didn't really happen in the U.S. Even though we, you know, rejected British authority, we still retained pretty much everything from British culture, and so... Pocahontas was able to remain a heroine in the same way. Sacagawea, who's another indigenous American woman, she was Shoshone, came about a couple hundred years later, gets the same kind of treatment. And both of those women are very much seen as these icons of American history. The other thing that's interesting is, you know, the fact that we can trace this narrative type back so far. And, you know, John Smith wrote his own memoirs and wrote a lot about his adventures. And I've always told people that his memoirs are incredibly entertaining, but you should always keep in mind that he knew a good story when he was making one up. He's not the most reliable narrator, but he tells a really exciting story. He writes about himself always in the third person, so it's a lot of, you know, and then John Smith saved the entire colony using only a stick and a, you know, rock, and then some people were mean to John Smith, so God struck them down with the plague, and, you know, there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
But there was a story that had another incident that had happened in Florida with, and I've gone blank on his name, but it was a Spaniard who was part of one of the teams going in and exploring and conquering Florida and got kidnapped and rescued by an indigenous princess. He did not actually have a romance with her, so the story became a little bit different there. But that story had been popularized in England around the time that John Smith was getting ready to go have his adventures. And it's very possible that his whole story about being rescued by Pocahontas while he was at the point of being executed was sort of a story he'd heard and knew was already in oral circulation. I think the most compelling evidence for me on that is the fact that he told that exact same story about two other places he went on his adventures. So either everywhere John Smith went, beautiful exotic women fell in love with him and rescued them from their, you know, from the point of execution by their evil male relatives, or, you know, there was maybe something else going on there. He also didn't tell that story about Pocahontas until shortly before her death and didn't publish it until after her death. So he kind of did this thing about, you know, not putting that out there until she was no longer around to refute it. So
right, because she did come over to England, didn't she? And she died in Deptford, I think.
She did, yes.
Yeah.
And is buried in Gravesend.
Yes.
Although I think her actual grave has been lost, but...
Yeah, yeah. And I think she was presented at court to Queen Elizabeth or King James?
I think it was King James.
King James, if it would have been James then. Yeah, yeah. No, and it's intriguing, that, isn't it? It's
the only image that we have that we know was made of her in life was made of her while, was an engraving that was made of her while she was in England. And so it's of her in British dress.
Mm.
And, you know, there's an interesting thing to think about there as well, about the fact that the only image we have of her is her dressed in, you know, the clothing of someone else.
Yeah.
And there's some interesting folklore about that particular outfit too. The she's wearing a hat in that engraving that has little metal kind of like buttons or studs around the edges. And there are people who claim to be descendants from the family who still claim to have those, but they're, you know, kind of circulating all over. And I think it's one of those cases where if you added all of the buttons together, there's way more than would have fit on one hat, but they've kind of come down like relics.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. I was looking on your heading more towards the true crime, your crime law podcast, which is at called Crime Law Pod or crimelawpod.com. And one of the characters, there's a story there about, and I'll make a mess of the pronunciation, La Llorona, who is a Mexican character, probably legendary, who supposedly wanders the world unable to attain rest because she murdered her two children in a fit of madness, probably.
Correct. And there's a lot of variations on the story, but yeah, the general gist of it is that she drowned her children after being betrayed by their father, who in some versions of the narrative is her husband. In some cases, they're not married. It's just a, he's definitely betrayed her for another woman. And so she drowns the two children, and then kind of coming to her senses, overcome by grief, drowns herself. And when she gets to heaven, God asks her, you know, where are your children? And she says, I do not know. So she was cursed to wander the earth forever looking for them. And La Llorona means the weeping woman. So she's set to wander along bodies of water, weeping, looking for her children. And it's used very much as a warning to say, you know, stay away from water at night, because if you don't, La Llorona will get you.
Oh, one of those, yes, sort of nursery bogies, you know, like Jenny Greenteeth and Peg Powler in the UK, yes.
Yes, and it, you know, and it's sort of migrated throughout, you know, there's now sightings and stories about it all throughout the United States and going down into Central America, and there's a similar figure called La Ciguanaba, who has a similar thing about water at night, but her thing is more so about seducing men. She's sort of appears as a beautiful woman and lures men to their deaths. But
La Llorona, no, say it wrong, totally wrong. Llorona, you know who I'm talking about.
Yes.
Again, it's she was a native Mexican woman, whereas her husband, her lover was a Spaniard again. So there's a sort of racial thing again in it.
It's very often told that way. And that's sort of the, as I said, sometimes they're married, sometimes they're not. And a lot of times it's that his family didn't approve of her because she was indigenous, because she was dark skinned, because she was poor. He's, you know, sort of wealthy and white. And it eventually comes to like him saying, oh, well, you know, I have to, you know, I now have to marry a woman who's of my own standing, whether that's racial standing or economic standing. That's why I have to leave you.
Going more now into the true crime side of things, how did that come about? How did the move from, if we like, conventional folklore to true crime get onto your agenda?
It, you know, kind of, I think like a lot of my research topics kind of happened by accident, by stumbling upon something and going, huh, this is kind of interesting. What's going on here? And then getting kind of swept up and digging deeper and deeper and deeper until all of a sudden I realized that had become my new research topic. But it really happened. I don't remember exactly how it happened. I guess I've always had kind of an interest in unsolved stories or stories that are not resolved in some kind of way, or, you know, left open-ended. I think a lot of people find them infuriating, and I find that something really fascinating about not knowing the end of a story and the kind of the gaps that are left there. And somehow or another, I can't remember how it started. I stumbled across one of these online crime solving forums. And it was one of those kind of moments as a folklorist I looked at and thought, okay, I have no idea what's going on here, but there's something really interesting going on here. And that kind of gradually more and more became my thing, that as I was finishing up my dissertation, when I'd have, you know, a spare moment here, a moment where I just had to get away from my dissertation, that I kind of stop and poke around on these forums and look at what was going on. And a couple things that fascinated me. The first thing I think was really just that, and there's a lot that can go wrong when you have amateurs trying to solve crimes, and, you know, we can talk about that, but there's also something really almost heartwarming, not almost, but definitely heartwarming about the fact that there are people out there that are willing to spend their spare time with nothing to personally gain from this, helping to solve crimes, helping to, there's a lot of work being done in identifying, you know, unidentified bodies and helping to give people back their names. And the degree, the extent of work that some of these people are doing, and there's one of the cases I always cite when I'm talking about, you know, this kind of just a, like, I don't know, civic duty kind of thing that you see with people, that a woman had posted about trying to dig into her grandmother's murder, which had happened decades ago and was never, no one was ever actually charged with her grandmother's murder, but it had kind of been categorized as having been committed by Otis Toole, who was a serial killer. But the truth about Otis Toole is that he confessed to a lot of crimes because he learned that he could get things out of confessing to crimes and, you know, get taken out to dinner and things like that. And he confessed to, you know, crimes that would happen in different states on the same date. He definitely confessed to crimes he didn't commit. Mm. And it turned out that the extent of his confession on that crime was basically the police driving him by the convenience store where her grandmother was shot and saying, "Didn't you kill an old couple over there?" And he said, "Oh, yeah." He, you know, never provided any details of it and, of course, was never charged with it. But once he had confessed, it there yep. became no, you know, reason to dig into it. And so decades later, this woman's trying to dig into it and figure, see if there's anything she can find at this late date. And immediately people chimed in and said, you know, "Well, I work near the courthouse that would have those records. If you want me to, I'd be happy to go over on my lunch break and see what I can pull." And, you know, just these kinds of things. And, you know, there's not going to be any glory in solving this kind of a case. It's not a high profile case. It's not a, you know,
yeah.
thing that there's documentaries made on. It's just a woman who's trying to figure out what happened to her grandmother. And people were willing to do this kind of work. And there's something, you know, we see so much dark stuff going on in the world, so much about people treating each other so terribly. To see people doing this for strangers is really kind of heartwarming. The other thing as a folklorist that really, I think, captured my attention was how much the stories that were being constructed to put together, you know, as people are trying to come up with a narrative to, you know, complete this unopened, this unended narrative, this open-ended narrative, how much it really resembled legends. And I think probably if I told most of the people in those communities that they resembled legends, they'd immediately get defensive, because I think a lot of people hear legend and think that that's synonymous with not true.
Yeah.
And as folklorists use the term, that's not at all the case. Something can be a legend and can be true at the same time.
Yeah.
They're not contradictory. In fact, one of the key qualities of a legend is that it's got a foundation in actual belief. Now that
yes, yes,
it's often contested. It's often,
yeah, yeah.
You know, a lot of times we tell stories and we're like, "I don't really believe this, but," or, you know, "I heard this from so-and-so," and it's kind of a, like, it's often a contested truth, but there is some kind of, you know, foundation in belief. But you see these same kind of structures that you see in legend. You see the same motifs recurring over and over again. And, you know, some of them, I think now these communities are starting to become conscious of how ubiquitous they are, to the point that you'll even see people kind of mocking them. But things that come up over and over again, like someone witnessing a drug deal and therefore, you know, being killed, or, you know, and sometimes in ridiculous places. Why would there be a drug deal going on in the middle of this, you know, place? Mm. But that's, you know, thing that's put up forth, running away to start a new life. Anytime someone's disappeared without a trace, that's a, you know, automatically a thing that's put forward.
Yeah.
You know, some of these, running into sex traffickers, obviously any kind of young female, that's always a, you know,
yeah.
thing that's put forward. And none of these things are things that are very often true.
Yeah. I noticed one of the other ones you had was about the organ stealing activities, and
yes.
you know, people we have this in the UK, and it's the same thing. People are kidnapped by men in white vans. There are a lot of white vans, but they're all actually Amazon delivery people these days. But, you know, and then waking up in a bath in some sort of grimy place, a bath full of ice water with a large hole in their side where a kidney's been removed and so on. So many stories. It just cannot be that frequent an issue. It can't really be a plague of people stealing kidneys.
Well, and, you know, that narrative, which is also very common in the U.S. and very much believed in the U.S. to the point of I have heard of it being, you know, sent out via official communications to, like, young military men in the U.S. Being told to look out for this sort of thing, with citing supposed actual instances that all get kind of sketchy when you try to track them down.
Yeah.
And the thing that's always kind of gotten to me about that one that challenges its believability is, I can believe that there could be people out there so despicable they would kidnap someone in order to steal their organs. But if they're that awful and that depraved, would they really then close them back up and put them in a tub of ice water to save their lives when they could potentially then give information about what had happened to them?
Yeah, that's a good point, yes.
Like, that's where the story starts to lose believability. But of course, you have to have that element so that you can have someone to tell the story. Otherwise,
yeah.
You know, if the person just disappears, then we can't have this narrative about their kidneys being stolen.
Yeah, and I mean, you talk also about, and again, we're sort of crossing over into folk and fairy tales and legends here, but the supernatural abduction. Originally, it was fairies, people stepping into a fairy ring and not being seen for another 7 years or whatever. And now it's alien abductions. And again, there's this overlap, isn't there, with mysterious disappearances?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing that's interesting to me is when we get on, you look on any of these crime-solving forums, for the most part, they're all very hostile to any kind of supernatural explanation. It's sort of a, you know, oh, no, we're dealing with what's real. We're dealing with reality, and those things aren't real. And it very much gets it to me, you know, the fact that we kind of live into this world where we at least believe that we're all part of a scientific rationalist mindset, that we're, you know, we believe in what we can see and what we can prove and all of that. And of course, it's all sorts of things that would challenge that. But, you know, those kinds of things aren't so much accepted. Sometimes alien abduction, maybe UFO things, there might be some credence given to it. But certainly if you when they're postulated a fairy abduction, that's never going to be an explanation that will be received well.
Yes.
But at the same time, some of the explanations that are put forth are, you know, just as wild, you know, when you see things, you know, like, well, I think the Unabomber and the Zodiac Killer and Jack the Ripper are all one person, or, you know,
yes,
that one's what I'm making up. But some of these wild theories, and people can buy into that, whereas they won't buy into something like a fairy abduction or the UFO abduction because it's something that is perceived as being grounded in reality, you know, the mindset. But I think there is something about some of these stories with, you know, you have to wonder, were fairy abductions a story that people put forth to explain things that they couldn't explain in much the same way that we're doing with UFO abductions or with, you know, just these missing person cases? What do you do when a person just absolutely vanishes out of nowhere? And it seems like that shouldn't be a thing that can happen. And it is very much a thing that happens. And, you know, first of all, there is always the possibility that, you know, people are being taken by aliens or fairies. I don't know. I can't prove either one of those things don't exist. Yeah. I haven't seen anything that's convinced me that they do, but certainly, you know, there are plenty of people that do believe in those things.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, as a researcher, always a fine, fine line to walk.
Yeah.
In terms of respecting people's beliefs, whether or not I share them. And also, you know, trying to not let my beliefs sway my, my research. But it's interesting to see some of these, you know, there's a theory that goes around, not just on the internet, but there's been, you know, some TV shows done about it, about a group of killers called the Smiley Face Gang who supposedly stalk young college age men and drown them in bodies of water and leave smiley face graffiti at the place where they have put them in the water.
Right.
And there's no, you know, actual suspects. There's no actual sightings of these killers. There's no, they're kind of still fitting in this realm that we have with, you know, fairies or with beings from other planets. And they, it started off with a series of drownings, I believe at University of Wisconsin La Crosse. It was at one particular university. And it started with this idea of, oh, well, we keep finding smiley faces near where we think they might have entered the water. And then when similar things started happening in other states, it was, well, maybe these, maybe this person is traveling around. And then when you started having, again, multiple drownings in different states on the same day, well, then all of a sudden it has to become a gang. It has to become this mm-hmm. organized group mm-hmm. of people that are doing this. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the list of people who are alleged to be victims, some of them, their deaths are very suspicious. Some of them, I think, probably foul play was involved to some extent or another.
Yeah.
But you also have to take into account, you know, one of the pieces of evidence people always use is, well, all of these guys fit the same category. They're all young white guys in their early 20s or late teens. Well, that's also a group of people who are known to sometimes not...
Not behave responsibly, yes.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
And, you know, the college campus where it start, where these cases started, where the theory originated, has a river that goes right through the middle of campus. Well, it's not terribly surprising that when you have young, intoxicated men wandering around, mm-hmm. sooner or later, some of them are going to fall into this body of water that goes right through the middle of campus.
Yeah.
You know, they're likely to engage in behaviors like deciding to go urinate in the water, which might put them on the edge where they could easily fall in.
Yep.
There,
yep.
You know.
Yes.
Or get this bright idea, I bet I could swim in that, you know, who knows. But
yeah,
there's lots of other explanations beyond this kind of shadowy thing. But I think it's kind of filling the same cultural role of this, like, thing to give us an explanation for these things that we don't find satisfactory explanations for. Because it's not a satisfactory explanation to think, oh, this guy just did something stupid and that happened.
Yeah.
Because I think we've all done stupid things and we don't want to have to grapple with the fact that, you know.
Yes.
We were just recording an episode for our podcast and we were talking about a case where a victim had left her door unlocked. And, you know, I said a couple weeks ago, I woke up in the morning and found out that I had left my door unlocked overnight. And that's something I would never do deliberately. And I know exactly how it happened. And I was, you know, kind of shocked and horrified, but we all make those mistakes periodically. Mm. And yet when someone is killed or attacked in those kind of circumstances, it's immediately put forth as a, yep, see, that's what if you have to lock your doors. Otherwise these kinds of things can happen. It almost becomes a victim blaming thing. And I think it's because we don't want to acknowledge that that could be us at any time.
And that also, if we're going to die, we'd like it to be for mysterious or noble reasons, not something mundane like being drunk and falling in the water.
Right. And, you know, more often than not, unfortunately, it is those mundane things. Well, I don't know if it's unfortunately or, you know.
Yeah.
More often than not, it's in much the same way that, you know, I've gotten into a discussion a few times about crime stories and whether they fit closer to legends or more in the realm of fairy tales or folk tales. And this all started from me reading an article somewhere where someone said fairy tales are essentially true crime stories. And as a folklorist who also studies true crime, I'm going to definitively say, no, they're not. I mean, there may be some that might be inspired by it. There's certainly some, you know, in fact, I think this one specifically cited Hansel and Gretel. And yes, certainly there are plenty of instances of parents abandoning children in the woods, and certainly plenty of instances of children who weren't being properly cared for one way or another, falling into harm's way. But I don't think any of them have ever encountered a witch living in a house made out of candy in the woods. there's a fantastical element that, you know.
Yeah.
Overall, while there's some crazy things happening in some true crime narratives, I don't think any of them get quite that far out there. But what is an interesting parallel is that fairy tales will tell some really difficult truths in a way that legends don't. So in legends, the killer lurking in the back seat or whatever is always mm-hmm. some stranger. It's always this shadowy figure in the bushes. Mm-hmm. And the reality is you're much more likely to be killed or attacked by someone who's close to you, someone who actually knows you.
Yes.
And in fairy tales, you get that, you know, it's fathers, it's mothers, it's, the person that you marry that you don't know as well as you think you do. That's where you meet with harm's way in fairy tales a lot of the time. And that is certainly a parallel between fairy tales and true crime stories.
Yes. I remember reading somewhere that I think it's 80% of, we're talking to the UK here, of murders are by family members or, and another substantial number are people who are known to the actual victim.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's very similar in the US. And in fact, I think in the US, something like 2/3 of female murder victims are killed by their intimate partners. Again, we don't want to think about that because we're like, well, yeah, but my intimate partner would never do something like that. Well, I think most people, I imagine that most of those victims didn't think theirs would either.
Yeah.
But we want to think it's a thing that we can exercise control over, that if that we are capable of making informed enough decisions that we wouldn't put ourselves in those kinds of situations.
But you can understand why people do go for the fantastic, where some people do appear to have just vanished from the face of the earth. Although, you know, sometimes it turns out that, as you were saying earlier, they wanted to start a new life and they just disappear and leave everything behind them, like the anti-hero in Far From the Madding Crowd, who swims off into the ocean or something and then returns years later.
Yeah, and I think that also gets at, especially when we have cases of people who've gone missing in in the U.S. we have a lot of stories of, someone that, disappeared in some wooded area or something like that. And they're like, the explanation will always be, yeah, but it was searched. So if they were there, they would have been found. Well, I've never engaged in search and rescue, but my understanding is that it's just not that reliable, that people are surprisingly easy to miss when you're searching a large wooded area. And especially if you're doing it immediately after the person's gone missing, that person could still be moving as well, which means that just because you've searched an area doesn't mean that they then didn't go right back there after you, but we want to believe that we have control over nature, and we don't.
Yeah.
But I think we in the US view ourselves as being so civilized that, we've tamed it all, and they were in a park, so it should be safe. Well, it's still nature. We still don't have that much control over it yet.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, there's some specific crimes. I've got a note here. Let's do some of the older ones. The Soda children disappearance. What's the significance of this particular one? Well, as opposed to just grieving parents unable to accept that their children died in a fire.
Well, so it's, there's a lot of things going on with this case. And the case, for people who aren't familiar with it, was a family in West Virginia who, on Christmas Eve night, the house went up in fire. It's a large family. I believe the couple had 10 children. One of them was away serving in World War II. This was in the 1940s. The 9 children were in the house. 4 of them got out. 5 of them were missing after the fire. It was initially assumed that they had probably perished in the fire, but there are varying reports, but there's no definitive evidence of their remains ever having been found. There are also a lot of things that were quite peculiar about the fire. First of all, the fact that it was officially explained as being an electrical fire, but the family says that the entire time the house was burning down, the lights were still on, which seems... and I'm not an electrician, I don't know this for sure, but their argument was that if the electrical wiring had been what caught on fire, that the power should have gone out first.
Yeah.
And, or at least quickly. and it didn't. They also pointed out that there was no sign of the children screaming, or they were the children who went missing. Their rooms were on the top floor, I believe the third floor. You know, that none of them were at the windows trying to get out, that there was no evidence of anything like that, which was, you know, offered forward as explanation. There were also things like both of the family cars mysteriously wouldn't start that night. There was a ladder which was normally kept by the house, and it had mysteriously gone missing. And a lot of things like that that made the family think something, that there was something suspicious about the fire.
Yes.
And so you have two separate mysteries here, really. You have what happened to the children and what was the cause of the fire. I think some things look more mysterious than they really are. You know, also, the other thing is that it took hours for the fire department to get there, by which point there was really not much for them to do.
Yeah.
Well, it was, and that, you know, I think seems like part of a conspiracy that the fire department was, you know, deliberately staying away to cause this to happen. Well, it was an all-volunteer fire department. It's during World War II, so most of the young men were gone. There were very few firefighters around. And it's also Christmas Eve, so it was hard to round people up. It's obviously not good that that happened. It's not okay that that happened. Obviously, if this had happened in your community, you'd want to find a way to prevent that from happening again. But it's not necessarily a conspiracy. There is also the fact that the family father, Mr. Sauter, was very outspoken as a critic of Mussolini. He was an Italian immigrant, and he had earned himself a lot of enemies, especially among the Italian community in that area, for being so outspoken against Mussolini. And shortly before the fire, he'd had an argument, I believe, with a door-to-door insurance salesman, where the man had screamed at him, you know, you think you've got it made. You think everything's so great. One of these days your children will, or your family will vanish and your house will go up in smoke.
Yeah.
And, you know, that happens shortly before this, his children disappear and his house goes up in smoke. The other thing about the children that went missing is that those happened to be the same five children that had been given permission to stay up late that night to play with some toys that they had gotten early for Christmas. And the mother had said she had come downstairs at some point before the fire started. She found one of her daughters, one of the ones who did get out, asleep on the couch in the living room. But all of the lights were still on, and the chores the children were supposed to do before going to bed, which included, you know, things like making sure the chickens were put up, so included outdoor chores, had not been done. And so one of the theories has been that the children had gone outside to do something as part of their chores and had interrupted this person that was starting the fire and were carried away because of that. You know, there were also lots of sightings of the children. There was a woman who came forward and said that the night after the fire, she had served a family in a diner that included these five children who seemed dazed and, you know, kind of out of it. Now, she didn't come forward for several years, so her, you know, testimony is a little bit suspect. There was a private detective that the family hired who went missing. Now, that's always seemed to me that he probably just took their money and absconded with it.
Yeah, yeah.
This is, of course, a time when it was a lot easier to go missing than it is now. You know, nowadays it's a little more difficult to just run off. But, you know, so there's a lot of things involved here, and I think it is absolutely partially so Mr. Sauter especially, but the other members, other surviving members of the family as well, you know, believed until the day that he died that his children had been kidnapped and that they were out there somewhere, and that no one was very frustrated that no one was listening to him. He, you know, there were lots of instances he spotted a child that he believed to be his youngest daughter in a magazine article about a school in New York City, and actually went there and went to the school and tried to speak with that child, and that child and her parents would not allow that to happen, which you can understand if that was your daughter and some crazy man shows up. You can understand that response as well, but you know, you can see his side of it being kept from this child, verifying that the child was his, and all of that. So yes, it is absolutely a grieving parent refusing to accept, you know, possible truth. Oh, the other really strange thing that I've left out. Well, there's two. So the fire chief had been telling people that he had found remains the night of the fire and that he had buried them in a metal box somewhere because he didn't want to tell the parents. Small town, he tells enough people that word eventually gets back to Mr. Sauter, who confronts him and eventually forces him to take him to where he's buried this metal box. And when they dig it up, there is something inside, but it looks remarkably fresh for having supposedly at this point been buried for years. And when it's taken for examination, it's found to be, I think, a cow's liver that was only a few days old.
Yeah.
And eventually the fire chief confesses, oh, okay, that was just a story I was telling people. It wasn't ever true. And then I, you know, put this together so that I could show you something.
Yeah.
So again, you know, if you're thinking that, if you're looking for evidence that your children are still alive, the fact that someone has forged evidence that they're dead certainly adds to that.
Yeah.
There was also not a thorough dig. There's never been a thorough archaeological investigation of the site, but there, Mr. Sauter, when he initially afterwards believing the children had perished in the fire and was so frustrating that the authorities weren't investigating the fire like he wanted it to, had bulldozed the site, which has created a big mess in terms of any later investigations. But there was some digging that went on that did recover some human bones, but they were of a male who I believe was, they said the youngest possible age that person could have been was 17, and they said it was somewhere like 17 to 23 was the age range. And the oldest child that disappeared, I believe, was 14.
Yeah.
So it shouldn't have been able to be any of their bones. It also appeared that those bones had never been exposed to fire. So if these are the bones of a child that died in a fire, you would expect to find scorch marks, and there weren't any found. There's never been a satisfactory explanation for where those bones came from.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of places that, you know, in sites where there's been human activity for a long time, there's plenty of reasons that there could be an unknown burial. Mm-hmm. But there's enough strange about the case. There's enough, and each of these things individually, you could maybe put together an explanation for, okay, well, this can be explained as this, this can be explained as this. But when you start stringing them all together, it really does sort of start to look like a conspiracy. It's easy to see how people look at this and say, okay, well, there was a conspiracy to burn down these people's house and use that as a cover for abducting their children. There was also a postcard that was received by the family years later with the name Lewis Sauter on it. Lewis was the name of one of the boys that disappeared, and a man's photograph who very much does look like an aged up version of their son. And that postcard was never able to be tracked down where it came from. So, you know, there's enough. Yes. You can see where when you can't get a satisfactory explanation, you're going to fill one in.
Yes.
And it's easy to construct a narrative, making it look like. And I'll say to this day, I don't actually know what I think happened. I'm more convinced about the house, the fire being arson than I am about the children being kidnapped. But you know, I think one thing that maybe wasn't well understood at the time that we definitely understand now is the fact that most fire victims actually die of smoke inhalation, and being on the third floor, they would have been exposed to smoke long before they would have been exposed to fire, which might explain why there were no screams or anything like that. But
yeah. And of course, we're talking 1945 when, and end of a war with lack of manpower, when probably fair to assume that the forensic science services available were not as sophisticated as they are now.
Correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Coming further forward, there's another story of disappearances and murders, which is one I'm not familiar with and probably not many people in the UK would be, and that's Crystal Grubb and Lauren Spira. What's the story there?
So those were two women who disappeared from the town that I lived in until recently in Indiana. Crystal Grubb was a young woman who had a difficult life. She was from a lower income family from southern Indiana. She had had a child very young. She had had some issues with substance abuse, and she went missing one day while out with a man she was romantically involved in and some other people. And those men have admitted that they were making meth that day, and that they had a fight and she stormed off. She was missing for, I believe, close to a year before her body was found eventually in a cornfield. And that story really got very little attention. It sort of, something that kind of just got maybe, a little bit of a notice in the paper, but overall there was no discussion of it until the next year. Lauren Spearer went missing. Lauren Spearer was an Indiana University student. She had been out at a bar one night with some friends and then went back to her place with one of them, where there was some sort of fight between the man she was with and her boyfriend's friends. The man she was with was not her boyfriend. And then they decided to go back to his place as a result of that confrontation. He and his friends say that she hung out with them that night until about 4:30 in the morning, and that at 4:30 she decided to go back to her own apartment. One of the men says that he watched her walk to the end of the block and then went inside, knowing she only had a two-block walk to get back to her own apartment. And she has never been found. There's never been any sightings of her. Her body's never been recovered. I'm not sure if she's officially been declared dead, but her parents have said that they assume at this point she's dead. She also had a heart condition, so if she wasn't getting daily medication for that, she would have been in trouble. And her case created a huge sensation. And it was always fascinating to me to look at the difference between the coverage and the public reaction to those two cases, because they were so similar. They were both young, attractive, blonde women who went missing after, possibly making some poor decisions. We know that Lauren was incredibly intoxicated the night that she went missing, to the point that she left her shoes and her phone at the bar she was at without noticing. And leaving your phone behind is bad enough, but leaving your shoes behind and not noticing that you have done that, you've got to be in quite a state for that. And the men she was with admitted that they used more drugs and alcohol when they got back to their place as well. So both, kind of engaged in some, poor choices. Again, a lot of us have made poor choices. But the differences were that, Crystal Grubb was a single mother who had had some encounters with the law and was from a lower income family. Yeah. Lauren was from a very wealthy family. Her family was from New York State. But she has a cousin who's a reasonably successful actress. She has a lot of family connections. And she was a college student, and I think in a college town, this really, kind of for a lot of people, made her seem like someone that they identified more with. It was this like, oh yeah, well, I did dumb things when I was in college too. And this town that revolved around that, she had, a sorority that helped publicize it. And I think still to this day, you'll see her photo, at least when I left, which was not long ago, at least up until a few months ago, you'll still see posters with her photo on it. And this has been 10 years now that she's been missing. She was written up by Time magazine a few years ago as one of the top 7 most mysterious disappearances. And there's been a lot of theorized possible connections between the cases. There has been for a long time rumors of a possible serial killer operating in the Midwest, targeting young blonde women. And so both of them would fall into that category. I think a lot of people really suspect that Lauren's friends had something to do with what happened to her. At the very least, I always say, at the very least, they're awful friends.
Yes.
Because, to let someone go in that state. And the one who had watched her walk to the end of the block later on came out and said, actually, I think I might have seen someone step out of the shadows and intercept her. And then went back inside and went to bed.
Yes. So,
like, you're saying this to try to
make it better.
Seem like you're less suspicious, and I think you're not helping your case. They also definitely lied to the police, man that was with her that had walked back to her apartment with her and then walked over to his place, claims that he doesn't remember the night because he was hit and he was punched in the head by one of her boyfriend's friends, and that the whole reason they went back to his place was because she was so concerned and she was taking care of him. Well, it's clear from video footage of that night that, in fact, she was the one who was really out of it, that at one point he was carrying her over his shoulder. We know also that she fell and hit her head at least twice on the walk from her place to his place. You know, so if anyone was in a state, it was her, not him, but he's, yeah, you know, claimed amnesia from this. And so I think a lot of people have long suspected them. And there's been some suspicion also on Crystal Grubb's friends that she was with. And I think in both cases, that's very possible. There's an interesting turn with Lauren's case where in the last few years, there's been a lot of kind of popular media, a little bit, again, kind of discussions on internet forums, as well as some podcasts connecting her case with Israel Keyes, who was a U.S. serial killer who has kind of taken on this boogeyman role a little bit. He's kind of now the person you plug in anytime. If someone went missing in a certain time span of time and you can't come up with any other explanation, you can always throw Israel Keyes in there, because he didn't have a clear victim profile and he didn't have a clear geographic kind of hunting ground. He lived in Alaska, but he had victims definitely in New England, and had victims almost certainly in Texas. So he traveled around a lot to commit his crimes in order to prevent suspicion falling back to him.
Yeah.
And what we do know is that he was in Indiana the night that Lauren went missing. And he has said, or he also, by the way, died from suicide in while he was in prison. So he can't answer questions about any of this anymore. But he had flown into Chicago the night before she went missing and was driving to New England that night, and would have been driving across the state of Indiana. And there's something about the time in which his car is recorded at certain toll booths that don't line up if he had gone straight from Chicago to where he to his destination. He seems to have made trips to the area before. She fits his victim profile a little bit in that he said he liked smaller victims because they were easier to dispose of. She was under 5 feet tall and weighed about 90 pounds, so she mm-hmm. was tiny. And that he also disposed of a lot of his bodies in deep lakes. There's a deep lake, Lake Monroe, right near Bloomington, which is where she went missing. And so interesting now, her story has been kind of connected with this kind of boogeyman figure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I was very skeptical of that explanation at first. I will say the more and more I've heard about, the more I go, okay, well, I guess that there could be something there. But I think it, again, is one of those, the likely explanation is pretty mundane.
Yeah.
And, but we prefer the fantastical explanation to the mundane explanation, because there's some kind of comfort in the fact, as much as it's terrifying to think you could just be walking home to your apartment one night and randomly encounter a serial killer who just happened to be in the area and wasn't looking for you in particular, but you just happened to wander into his path. That's a terrifying thought also. But there's something even more terrifying about the fact that it could just be that you had too much to drink and you hit your head and you were with friends that didn't look out for you like they should have.
Yes, and I suppose we're almost getting to a point where the mysterious serial killer is now taking over from fairy abductions and aliens as the dramatic explanation, which is very hard to prove or disprove.
Right, and I think that we definitely have kind of turned serial killers into this kind of contemporary monster narrative, to the point that I did kind of a perusal of the nicknames that have been given to serial killers. And there's, you know, I think something like 40 that have the word monster in the nickname that they were given, you know, the monster of such and such place, the monster of, and you get a lot of, you know, supernatural names, you know, werewolves, vampires, those things get attached. Going back to fairy tales, there's quite a few that have Bluebeard in their name, Bluebeard being a figure out of fairy tales that has been marrying women and then locking them up and killing them. And that name has been attached to quite a few male and female serial killers. There was one from Indiana, Belle Gunness, who was called the Lady Bluebeard. But I think they are very much kind of fitting that cultural role. And again, it's something we can kind of make fit within our scientific rationalist mindset.
Mm-hmm.
But then we don't have to limit them to the, you know, bounds of behavior of normal people either. We can, they can be these cultural boogeymen because they can be that figure in the shadow that we can't always prove and we can't explain.
And we're fast running out of time. What projects are you working on, along with obviously your academic work and your crime law podcast? What other things are you working on? Any new books?
So I do have a book that just came out at the start of last month. It's an edited volume called Advancing Folkloristics, which is kind of looking at new avenues in folklore research. I have, that's co-edited with two of my colleagues, one of whom is my co-host on Crime Lore, Jesse Fivecoat, and then Meredith A.E. McGriff, who is also one of our colleagues. And it looks at, you know, all sorts of things from looking at internet folklore, queer folklore. You know, it's a little more academically inclined, certainly, than my podcast or these sorts of projects. I have, the reason I've just moved to Texas is that I have just started as the executive director for the Texas Folklore Society. So hopefully in the next year, maybe Texas Folklore will have its own podcast as well.
That's brilliant.
We're working on some projects there and figuring things out from there.
Christine, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you ever so much for your time. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. Thank you so much for having me on.
Once again, a big thank you to this week's guest, Dr. Christina Downes. You can find her Crime Law podcast at www.crimelawpod.com. That's law as in L-O-R-E, folklore, and not L-A-W. And you can follow her on Twitter at Leaping Princess. Yes, Leaping Princess. As ever, we'll have the links in the Urban Fantasies website and in the podcast and YouTube metadata. Now it just remains for me to say, this is Charles Christian saying, thank you so much for listening in. Please join me again next week for more strange tales for strange times. Until then, stay well. Stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com, by email to urbanfantasist@icloud.com, and on Twitter at @urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.